I'm Zoe Williams, and this is Counterpower, the podcast for global solidarity. Last summer, the normalisation of Islamophobia in the UK showed up in some stark YouGov polling. Half of Britons thought Islam was incompatible with British values. 41% believed that Muslim immigrants had had a negative impact on the UK. Almost a third thought that Islam promotes violence. Then in October, Britain's Jewish community faced the appalling attack on Heaton Park Synagogue in Manchester. It left two men dead and three others seriously injured. More religious hate crimes are committed against Jews than any other group in this country. Their surge is a pattern we see across the world, from Paris to Bondi Beach. Islamophobia and anti-Semitism, ever more openly and violently expressed, have transformed the experience of being Muslim and Jewish and have an ongoing seismic effect on society. Yet the bigotries themselves are rarely discussed. Instead, they're used as carrier issues for other conversations about immigration, about national security and foreign policy, about public order and political discord, about anything except their fundamentals. But how is this hatred generated? Who bankrolls it? Who profits from it? What purpose does it serve? Whose movement is it building? Why does the liberal order seem so powerless to do anything but react astonished to each fresh atrocity? And how has life changed for British Jews and British Muslims? On today's show, I'm joined by two brilliant guests to help us find some answers. Shaista Aziz from Three Hijabis and Stop Trump Coalition, and Em Hilton, a Jewish organiser and writer based in London and co-founder of NAMOD, UK Jews Against Israel Occupation and Apartheid. Okay, so Shaista, Em, welcome to the show. Shaista, can you tell me how this has unfolded from your end, whether we're talking about microaggressions or outright aggression, whether it's been more noticeable interpersonally or institutionally? What assumptions do people make about you now that they wouldn't have done before Brexit 10 years ago?
So your question's really interesting. I think it's all of that, and it's multi-layered, all of it. I think, though, it's important to really emphasise that Islamophobia, the hatred of Muslims, is systemic. It's not about an incident involving one person on the street or someone at work. It's much, much deeper than that. You know, I was born and raised in the UK, in Oxford, and when I was much younger, I was not so scared about being a Muslim, a visible Muslim in this country. My concerns, like a lot of young girls, were more about violence against women and girls on the street. You know, like a lot of girls, I was conditioned, you know, when I was going to my football practice after school or my netball practice after school, to walk around with my keys in my hand so I could try and defend myself if a man tried to grab me or attack me or anything like that. As I've got older, I have to be frank and tell you that I'm mostly the violence that I've experienced, which has been a lot, by the way, in the last 10 years, during the Brexit years in particular, has been directed at me because of my faith. So the fact that I wear a headscarf, the fact that I wear a hijab, makes me visible as a Muslim woman. And then the intersections of being a woman, so the misogyny, and then the race, all combine together. Mm-hmm. And they create a very violent and frightening dynamic. And it's not just me. There's plenty of data out there that shows that since 2024 in particular, there has been a massive rise in Islamophobia across the UK, and predominantly it's British Muslim women who are facing the brunt of this. And I don't think this is by accident either, because if you look at the trajectory of the far right, not only here in the UK but in Europe, they use the issues around Muslim women, patriarchy, abuse that women face across the world, but specifically we're talking about Muslim women, they use it as a lightning rod to try and attract more members into the organised far right, and to also victimise and stereotype Muslim women as being women who need to be saved, not only by our own so-called men in our own communities, but basically the far right kind of offer themselves as being the only ones who can save us, as absurd as that sounds.
And do you, and how does it bleed in kind of, you know, in terms of class? You're talking about, you kind of see far right mobs and you know, you see the Tommy Robinson march and realize what a tinderbox that is. But do you think the kind of political spaces, in, you know, you're really involved with Oxford Council, in that kind of space, do you see people making assumptions about being Muslim that they would never have, it wouldn't have even occurred to them
all day long, all day long. I mean, honestly, it happens pretty much every day to me, which might sound really shocking for someone listening to this. But, you know, being a British Muslim woman, nothing is expected of me. It's almost like seen as a surprise if I can string a sentence together in the way that I'm trying to do now. People don't expect anything of you or from you, and they have an assumption of who you are, what you believe in, and it's really not hard to kind of dispel any stereotype they have, because the stereotypes they have are multiple, and, you know, there's so many of them, right? So people are surprised that you have a personality. You know, you introduced me as one of the three hijabis. We're three British Muslim women who work on the intersections of race, gender and Islamophobia, particularly in football. And when we came to the sort of public forefront during the last time that the men's Euros were held in this country in 2023, the number of journalists, so we're talking mostly about middle class, white, educated so-called people, a lot of the men, they were stunned that, you know, you're a Muslim and you're a woman and you choose to wear a headscarf and you like football. And it's like, yes, buddy, strap up. Wait for the rest of the story, right? So it really is that. I mean, I know I sound like I'm being facetious and making fun, right? But this is one way of sort of staying grounded and staying human, because it gets very, very boring. You know, the amount of time I've had people say to me, oh, you're not like them. You're not like the rest of them. I used to get this when I was at school. Okay, so when I was like 8 or 9 years old in the school playground, I used to have people coming up to me who, some of them were my friends, and they'd say things to me like, you know, they use a racial slur, the P word, and they say, you're not like them. You're different to them. You don't smell like them. You don't look like them. And this type of disgusting racism is really very, very mainstream. And in very well-known places where I've worked, I've had these types of conversations taking place in the workplace, where white liberal people are coming up to me, you know, near the coffee machine to talk about the Moroccans or, I don't know, whichever race of people they want to talk about. And then they're looking at me saying, but you're not like them. And I'm like, I can't believe that I'm being subjected to this same conversation. Yeah. It's a different victim. You know, those asylum seekers, those whatever you want to, you know, swap an asylum seeker with. But it's that whole presumption that because you're here in our space, in this liberal, educated white space, you're okay because you're different to them. And this goes to the heart of the intersection of class and racism and Islamophobia and misogyny as well, because the amount of casual misogyny and sexism that comes my way because of the fact that I choose to wear a hijab is really also really very boring and shocking as well.
I mean, in a way, it is the same question to you about assumptions and how assumptions have changed. And another question, do you feel physically threatened? Does it change the way you move through the world?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on, Zoe, and Solidarity Shyster. Shyster and I have known each other a long time, and I'm really grateful to be here and having this conversation with both of you. I think the last year has been incredibly difficult for a lot of Jewish people. We're seeing this, the political violence, which feels increasingly common in our current world, obviously has had a significant impact on Jewish people. Obviously the horrific Manchester attack on Yom Kippur this year, but then I actually also grew up in Australia in the Bondi Jewish community, and obviously the attack there was really horrific that happened on Hanukkah in December of last year. So very much this sense of what does it mean to be thinking about our safety is a really front of mind question for a lot of Jewish people. But I think just also not only Jewish people, you know, I think that this is also indicative of the current political moment with rising extremism and authoritarianism, and the rise of the far right shows that actually this question of how do we keep lots of different communities safe, both Muslim communities, Jewish communities, trans people, migrants, asylum seekers, we're all under threat from the rising far-right shift. And also this sense that the liberal center does not have an answer to the deep political problems that we're facing. And, you know, I feel it's particularly important to talk about this because what has happened in the last few years is there have been these significant attempts to silo or separate out the fight against anti-Semitism from the fight against the broader anti-racism struggle, from challenging other oppressions and building a world that allows all people to thrive wherever they are. And I think we can really clearly say that that approach is failing. You know, are seeing this increase in political violence. So what does it mean to take a new approach and really think about what does it mean to be in solidarity with others facing these threats? And if not necessarily be safe, because I think, you know, there's a big question around safety at this time. How do we band together in this moment and take on these issues?
It feels to me like that before you get to the necropolitics, before you get to the politics of who gets to live and who gets to die, who gets to be harmed and who doesn't, there's a kind of strategic silencing. So, you know, as a Jewish person who isn't a Zionist, you're silenced. As a Muslim, you're silenced because you don't fit, as you say, the kind of picture that the liberal establishment has of Muslims. There's a lot of strategic circumspection.
Definitely. I mean, I think what we are, you know, in terms of when you talk about the threat to Jewish people, I would actually say the most sort of threats I've had publicly or online or attacks have been from people who support Israel and don't like my politics.
Yeah.
And that's actually where I've seen that violence and this threat of violence, rather, and a real unwillingness from, you know, the so-called communal leaders in the Jewish community, but also sort of the public, sort of people who are sort of trying to determine these conversations, an unwillingness to actually call this out and say what it is. And, you know, from my perspective, my politics is governed from a position that all people deserve to live with freedom and dignity and justice. And that's Palestinian folks in Gaza and in Palestine. That's Jewish people here. That's Muslim folks here in the UK. And that's what drives me.
Yeah.
And to see that being used as a point to potentially, like, people who are threatened by that and want to shut that down because it challenges their political worldview is really frightening.
Yeah, you know, it's really frightening. And it's the denial of plurality, isn't it?
Yes,
it's really
exactly,
disgraceful.
Yeah.
And it's people who have their own political agenda, and most of it's men, mostly men, who are desperate to wield more and more power. They're the ones who want to deny plurality. And then you find so-called mainstream governments doing the same thing
again.
Yeah. It's really disgusting. And what it does is it makes our attempts to stand up for plurality in our own communities much, much harder.
Much harder.
To stand up for everybody else's human rights as well. I mean, I would like everyone to know that whenever there's a global horrific act of terrorism happening against the Muslim communities, one of the first people to ever check in with me is always M, and vice versa, right? That happens all the time, you know? And that's not abnormal. That is absolutely normal. And I think what's not normal is how these narratives of being, these political narratives have taken a life of their own, that you can't be in solidarity with each other.
Yeah.
You know, as my Jewish sister sat here, she can't be in solidarity with me and I can't be in solidarity with her. This is not how the real world works.
I think also I totally agree, Shaista, and I think what we have happened is the essentializing of our identities to further a political project that actually have nothing to do with actual care and concern for Jewish communities or for Muslim communities when that happens, vice versa. And I think it's important that we're talking about this now because we know that Reform UK have launched their Reform Jewish Alliance and Friends of Israel group. And we know that they're going to, as the far right often does and political figures do, they often use this issue of supposed care for Jewish people or wanting to combat anti-Semitism to launder the racism and bigotry that they have towards other groups, particularly Muslim communities and particularly migrant communities.
Yeah.
And this is why it's very important to be having conversations like this and offering an alternative and really compelling those who can to take action and challenge the ways in which our communities are so instrumentalized for political projects of repression, of authoritarianism, of anti-democratic positioning.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have a responsibility, particularly in this time when that is gaining so much traction in a mainstream context, to really be challenging that and speaking out.
And in our communities as well.
Yes, right? Absolutely.
There's too many people in our own communities
definitely
who don't have this knowledge, who don't have this understanding. It doesn't mean that they rampant anti-Semites or rampant Islamophobes, far from it actually. But I think we also have to have space to get things wrong and to be able to call in as opposed to call out and offer people the opportunity to learn, to understand. And that doesn't always seem to be the case. And I think that's dangerous as well.
So I think there's so much going on there. In the first instance, there is something from the political and media establishment that requires all Muslims or all Jews to speak with one voice. Mm-hmm. And even, you know, that could be somebody on the Today programme who requires everybody to agree, everybody of the same faith to agree. And that is an incredibly pervasive and poisonous thing, which I don't know. I don't know whether that's always been true and I just am only now noticing, or whether that has really crept up on the discourse.
Well, I think it's got much worse. So I think it's always been there. However, partly as well, it's something to do with lazy journalists as well, right? You know, the world is far more nuanced than a lot of the journalistic output that's out there. But I think particularly after 9/11 and the atrocities in New York, this whole narrative took a life of its own. Who speaks for British Muslims? Well, shock, horror, British Muslims. It's not a group, it's not an organisation or one individual that speaks for all of us, right? And now there's been a very similar debate that's taken place since the genocide started in Gaza and since the horrifying crimes against Israelis on October the 7th, right? There's a similar discourse that started, I think, which is about, you know, British Jewish people trying to tell other Jewish people that you're wrong or you're not Jewish enough, or if you believe in this, then that's okay. If you don't believe in that, that's not okay. It's actually been very painful to watch this unfold because it's something I can relate to as a Muslim in this country, and this whole attempt to decide who speaks for me, who speaks for any one of us. And it's like, well, no one does. You know, we're thankfully not a homogenized group of people and we have plenty of views and opinions, and there's never going to be one entity, one group, one organization or one person that's going to speak for all of us. Why would that be the case?
Yeah, I think that's very true. And, you know, we have, and I'm sure I'll come on to it a bit more when I talk a bit about Nahmad, but, you know, there is this attempt by, you know, and that's very common in moments of like political crisis that, you know, those who hold power want to retain it. Yeah. And these institutions, you know, the Board of Deputies and the Chief Rabbi were actually set up in the 19th century by the British state to be like, these are the Jews we speak to get the opinions. You know, this is part of a colonial legacy of the British state that really does actually just want to talk to one representative and wants that monolithic positioning around Jewish people or around other communities because that's easier for them to handle and not actually about, you know, what does it mean to meaningfully engage with different minorities? But yeah, as I was saying, I think these institutions, which are not representative, you know, there's no such thing as like as a monolithic community. There's always going to be differences of opinion. There's always going to be people who've had disagreements, especially in the Jewish community. You know, we know the old joke, two Jews, three opinions. That's part of our worldview. But I think when that's dangerous is what it's saying is that when that is done in service of a position around what's happening in Gaza, when you have organizations unequivocally supporting Israel's genocidal destruction, that's very dangerous for Jewish people because it can represent us or present us as emissaries or ambassadors of what Israel's doing.
Right.
And that can actually increase the risk and the harm that can come to Jewish people because it's saying, well, you support this. You all must support this. And that's one of the reasons that I think so many Jewish people have felt compelled to speak out against Israel's genocide in Gaza, not just because obviously we have a moral imperative to do so as human beings, but there is right now a bit of a struggle or a power struggle as to who actually, who gets to say what Jewish people believe, what they want. And I think the most important thing, as Shaista said, is plurality, but also this idea of dissent and that dissent is welcome. And I think what's important with that is that I don't think the sort of dynamics in the Jewish community in the UK right now are that different from what's happening in our broader society, which is this attempt at repression, at challenging people's rights to protest or speak out. You know, we're seeing this consistently, not just on this issue of the genocide in Gaza, but more broadly. And that's why it's really important to be really protecting that space and making sure so many different voices can be heard, but also pushing for a position in which, you know, the forces, like the right-wing forces, can't actually say you're the ones who are harmful as the ones who actually want to protect free speech, because we're also seeing that happen too.
And you know, when we talk about homogeneity in a kind of faith group, you're basically, in order to achieve that homogeneity, you have to shut down a huge number of people in order to get one voice that agrees. But they are, it does look like many tendrils of a silencing movement. So whether it's kind of prescribing Palestine Action as a terrorist group or shutting down a possibility of dissent within any kind of single faith group, there's just a number of like gating off of speech, which is really fascinating. And I think you can see it more clearly in Islamophobia and anti-Semitism than you can see it in the general population.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's also what we see is sort of a, you know, it's very complex. But I think that what you also see is that I've seen the Jewish communal leaders or institutions make strange bedfellows or align themselves with movements or politicians or political figures that will allow them to sort of maintain this idea that they are representing the community over the actual safety and well-being and interests of the community.
Right, it's about access to power, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's very, very refreshing to actually have a podcast with two women of faith and the fact that we're women, because the gatekeeping that goes on in communities of faith, particularly around not having women's voices heard and representative voices heard, is really very high. And then to go back to your point there, Zoe, I think that when the stakes are so, so high for people to call out a genocide, to call the thing that is literally happening in front of our face, that we've been seeing every day on our phones, on our TV screens, on our computer screens, to actually call that what it is, the stakes are very high. To actually name it what it is.
Yeah.
And that's done on purpose to not only scare the minorities who are then being targeted by racist thugs and on the streets, but also racist politicians, but everyone else as well. Because what we're told is, you know, stay in your lane, be quiet, be silenced. Otherwise, you will have to pay a high price for this.
Yeah. I mean, you use the word instrumentalized, and I look at it and I feel like that each faith is being instrumentalized in a different way, and in an incredibly obvious gaslighty way, but it's very, very hard to call it. And actually, it's part of the silencing, is that you can't call it when you're not of the faith, but then you're not allowed to call it when you're inside the faith either. So I look at the way, you know, there's been a huge amount of basically racist talk out of Shabana Mahmood, for example, and she's kind of instrumentalizing her racial identity in order to curry favor with a racist narrative or a racist segment of the electorate, but then kind of use her personal identity as a way to gate off criticism that she's racist. And that's kind of a basic example. You could say the same thing about a lot of Kemi Badenoch's fashioning, the way she kind of fashions herself as this tough talker, but actually says some incredibly racist things.
Yeah, because, you know, just because you are black or white or whatever colour you are, does not actually make you exempt from not having very, very odious views and, supporting racism, supporting fascist ideas, supporting racism, supporting very extreme ideas around othering people. And I think this is part of the problem I have with the so-called lived experience. You know, Shabana Mahmood and I, you know, our families are from the same part of the world, Pakistan. She says she was raised as a working class British Pakistani, but so was I. But that's about the only thing that we have in common, right? And I'm not going to have much more in common with her because I don't hold the same views as her. So the presumption, the sort of presumption that because, you know, her lived experience then gives her the keys to unlock more racism and really shocking rhetoric, you know, that she thinks she can come out with around refugees and migrants because she is the colour that she is deeply problematic.
There was this moment after the attack on Manchester where, you know, the blood was still on the floor of the synagogue when this happened. And immediately Shabana Mahmood was briefing the press that she was going to put in this cumulative protests or attack or restrict further rights to protest for the Palestine movement, like creating these links that weren't there.
Yeah.
And it really just felt in that moment as if like this is not really about caring about Jewish people. This is not about addressing this horrific attack. This is about your political agenda of repression and silencing at people's rights to protest. And not only are you doing that, but you're using Jews as the excuse for that.
Yeah.
And you're fueling this sense that actually the reason you can't go to a protest or the reason that you can't like Gary Lineker anymore or whatever it is because of the Jews.
It's
truly offensive and upsetting and really puts Jewish people and of course also Muslim people as well at risk in this country. And you have to ask yourselves, what politics is that serving? What is Shabana Mahmood trying to do in that moment?
Well, it's so interesting, isn't it? Because she's instrumentalizing anti-Semitism as a way to shut down dissent, but she's also instrumentalizing her own Muslim identity as a way to gate off criticism. And you're like, well, this is just so outrageous.
Totally.
But it's very difficult. I mean, it's very difficult. And I think maybe it's like it's just a kind of longer, it's not even a conversation. It's a kind of gestalt worldview of how you can, of what response a thinking person could have to that kind of cynicism. Because it's very hard to
And the people who benefit are the right, who are going to try and make a very simple narrative out of it. And you know, the fact that the progressives do not have our backs in this time is really, really worrying.
Yeah, I'm not even sure how progressive they are, to be honest with you, Anne. I've always been very suspicious of people who believe they're progressive. Because in this country, a lot of progressives have spent too many decades pearl-clutching. And when they hear about some incident of racism or structural racism, the usual response, which is very tiresome because it's the response that's always wheeled out, is really? But this country's so open and so liberal, and are you sure? And I didn't know. And it's like, well, you didn't know because you don't want to know. Not everybody lives my life. That doesn't mean that I'm not curious about what lives they do live.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that I don't understand that I have a responsibility to wider society and the communities that I'm part of, which is all communities, by the way. I'm an active citizen, therefore it's my responsibility to know what's happening and to engage with what's happening and to stand up and be counted.
Right, let's take a break here. When we come back, we'll talk about the evolution of these prejudices and their distinctive 21st century iterations.
Hi there, I'm Nick Dearden from Global Justice Now, and I've got a small request. Counterpower isn't just about conversation, as great as that is. It's about turning ideas into action and building real community power. That's why we have a simple pledge to you, our audience. On every single episode, we'll leave you with something that you can do, big or small, to catalyze change. Whether it's the latest big ideas or the movements you need to check out, you'll find them on Counterpower. But to do all of this, we need your help to launch the project. We know it's got great promise, but to get it off the ground, we need your support. We're aiming to raise £8,000 to kick off this exciting project. To support our launch, please go to the crowdfunder linked in the show notes. And one more thing, whatever you do, don't forget to subscribe, like, and follow so that you never miss an episode. And if you like what you hear, leave us a review.
Right, we're back. And I want to go into the evolution of you know, Islamophobia and anti-Semitism as we're experiencing them right now. So, tell me about how NAMMOD came about. What were you responding to? I think the media expectation of British Jews, I think we've kind of, with like looking at us, this monolith. It's so frustrating.
Yes, it is. It is frustrating. So NAMMOD was started in 2018, and I think it was responding to two things. I mean, first, it was something that has been spoken about a lot, but just the way in which so many of us grew up in Jewish communal life in Australia, here it's very similar, where we were actually in many ways given clear values around justice and tikkun olam, to heal the world, that it's important to look out for your neighbors, equality, human rights, etc. But when it came to Israel, a lot of those values were left at the door. And that the important thing when it came to Israel is that we supported the state no matter what.
Right.
And that's definitely how I grew up. And after, you know, spending a lot of time unlearning a lot of the narratives that I was told about Israel, about how, you know, it only acts in defense, it's the most moral army in the world, you know, this is my liberation, actually, this is my sense of safety. The only way I was able to address that was by both spending time in Palestine with Palestinians and being part of sort of solidarity efforts for that, but also challenging the idea that what keeps me safe is harming and oppressing Palestinians. And having gone through that process, I realized that actually, and many of us realized that there was lots of us together who saw the need that to address this, to address the moral crisis that was taking place in our community around this unequivocal support for Israel, and how that was really eroding our Jewishness, but it was also eroding our moral compass. And that was really important to address. But the second thing we were trying to think about was exactly what we're talking about, the ways in which these institutions, these outdated institutions, want to say that they represent all Jewish people, and often put ahead of supporting or representing the needs of the communities here in the UK, they will often prioritize defending Israel, supporting Israel in this way that I think actually is very harmful and really puts Jewish people in the UK at risk. So that's why we decided to start Na'amod, to make sure that we were ending our community's support for Israeli occupation and apartheid and really doing that internal work, particularly because of the way in which politicians, whether they're Tory, whether they're Labour, whether Reform, you know, use Jewish people as justification for their own anti-Palestinian politics and anti-Palestinian racism. It's very clear that, you know, you don't actually need to say the Jewish community wants something if you don't want to stop trading with Israel, but it sure helps, you know, to be able to have that scapegoat. And that is actually part of a historic way in which Jews are often used by people in power as shields for the sort of dirty work that they might want to do. You know, we've seen this back to the, you know, we can talk about the Middle Ages, where the king used to send the Jews out as tax collectors. We can talk about it in the context of, you know, even sort of within the early days of the Zionist Project, where they sort of say that they were sort of protecting Jewish communities instead of like just actively being honest about their own anti-Arab racism. And when I'm talking about the Balfour Project there. And so it's really, really important for us to be thinking about not only connecting that important internal work that the Jewish community must do to confront the reality of Israel's apartheid and its genocide against people in Gaza, but also to think about how this is then used to further a violent and repressive politics more broadly.
I mean, the thing is that I at exactly the same time as Na'amod was being established, could see in British politics the way it was, the way anti-Semitism was being used in order to destroy the left, and destroyed it really effectively. But it also, particularly in that 2018-2019, was used as a fig leaf for Boris Johnson, being the scourge of anti-Semitism, gave him a pass for all the openly Islamophobic things that he'd been saying since 2008. So I was looking at it and thinking, this is a very specific answer to some very specific British problems, or like political Gordian knots that they just wanted to slice through. But then you know, exactly the same thing was happening in Germany. Exactly the same thing has happened in America. And I wonder, what the hell, man? Like, how did that network, how did that use value accrue to these narratives in so many places at the same time?
Well, I think we should be open about the fact that the right across the world have been consistently, somewhat ironically, working internationally for a long time, and that they are trading tricks and resources and strategies. And, you know, we see that in the sense of, like, very obviously now with Elon Musk appearing at the Unite the Kingdom march. We see that with, you know, Modi and Netanyahu's relationship. We see that with
Tommy Robinson in Israel.
And also the CPAC conferences. Like, these things are happening. You know, that's very obvious. But I think in terms of that point that you said around what was happening around, you know, there has been a real clear attempt to cleave off Jewish people away from the broader anti-racism struggle, from the broader sense of that, you know, essentializing us as the only things we care about are Israel and anti-Semitism, mm-hmm. which is also not true. I think, like, you know, I also yeah. have concerns about my electricity bill, but that, you know, but I think it's important because yeah. we're seeing also this rise in support for the Green Party in the Jewish community in the UK. You know, 18% of Jewish people said they might vote Green at the next election. That's very significant because mm-hmm. we are all being affected by the broader political problems that exist.
Yeah.
But that process of siloing is intentional, and it is about cleaving us off and saying the only way we can feel safe is if those in power are looking out for us. But that is a false promise of safety.
Right.
Is very similar in mirrors what's been happening since 9/11,
yeah.
since the atrocities in the USA, where there's been a massive movement from different communities to Sikh community, for example, Hindu community, for example, to say, we're not Muslim. We might look brown, but we're not Muslim. So please, go and, if you've got a problem, go and deal with those people over there. They're the Muslims. We're not the Muslims.
Has that been incredibly divisive in ways that maybe hasn't been
absolutely
kind of,
and it's taken a life of its own again, and politicians know this. So when they're specifically talking about Muslims, they're not talking about Hindus, they're not talking about Sikhs or Christians, and neither should they be in these dehumanizing, horrifying ways. They also understand that actually what we're going to do is we're going to separate this group of people, which is ironic because Muslims are always accused of wanting to be separate of everybody else. But you know, being separately looked at, separately targeted, being very much treated as a security issue, as a fifth column within this country and other countries. And that is how the community is overwhelmingly dealt with through that whole lens of securitization. And as we know, since 9/11, the militarization of, the police across Europe, across other parts of the world, as we're seeing with ICE, for example, in the USA, again, has just been turbocharged.
Yeah.
And it's very hard to really, in mainstream narratives now, to separate Muslims from immigrants, from refugees, from mm-hmm. terrorists, from paedophiles, from grooming gangs. All deliberately, all those lines have deliberately been blurred. And even if you don't say Muslim, 99% of the time, the word Muslim does appear in people's minds or in their thinking, not because they're all rampant Islamophobes, but because they are, digesting the dominant message that's been given to them to digest by mass media, by politicians and others who are very much responsible for building up this narrative.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the first time I saw Wahedja Ali's research, and this would have been like 2009, mm-hmm. 2010 maybe, about the spike in Islamophobic coverage in the US media, and tracing who had funded it, where it had come from. It was really extraordinary how exponentially it had grown, that Muslim was being used in a pejorative sense. It was being associated with, as you say, terrorism, violence, the hatred of women. I think that sex crimes and paedophilia has been a recent addition to that. This was kind of bolt on. Mm-hmm. But there was a kind of really steady and quite dramatic rise in the way that happened. But I think maybe even that we kind of see that, and it's so obvious that it's almost become a cliche before we've digested how that changes the condition of being Muslim in the world.
Yeah. And all of this is being internalized mm-hmm. by Muslims everywhere as well. It's not just a question of, you know, this narrative is only there to be consumed by white people. This narrative is there to be consumed by everyone. I mean, I'm going to tell you this very quick story because I'll always remember this. My nephew, when he was, I don't know how old he was, maybe he was 10 years old, he walked into his grandma's house and he saw this picture on the wall, and he was laughing, very, very, very nervous laugh. And I said, "Are you okay?" And he said, "Yeah." And he was pointing to this picture of this old man. And so he just kept laughing. And he said, "I can't believe you've got this on your wall." And I said, "Who do you think this is, darling?" And he said, "Osama bin Laden." And I said, "No, this is the founder of Pakistan, Muhammad Ali Jinnah." And in most Pakistani households, there are images of Muhammad Ali Jinnah, some houses, images of the Queen, for example, and Princess Diana, and all lots of other people. And I was just like, wow, my mum's grandson thinks that she's got a picture of Osama bin Laden on the wall because it's an older man with a hat who looks foreign, right? Yeah. Now, I was just very happy that I asked him who he thought that was because he would have gone away thinking my grandmother's got this,
that
you know.
Was, that was good auntie work. That was
really I know, very good auntie work, right? Yes, I was on it, right? But, you know, it's really devastating. Yeah, I was like, course, this course. Is completely bonkers.
Yeah.
But then if I look at it, what else would he possibly think it is? Because if that is the only, the dominant narrative that he's being, he's having to see and hear about, you know, him, you know, his family, his, the community that he's part of, you know, then that's logically what he might end up thinking. But my goodness me, how horrific.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, I'm sorry, I feel really emotional about that story because I think it really speaks to that internalization of the hatred that exists in the world, and I think that a lot around you know, I think a lot of Jewish people for the last, you know, 2 years of this ongoing genocide that we're witnessing also feel this deep shame about what Israel is doing in our name, and this sense that, you know, this complicity, which is a complicated thing. You know, I think there's, you know, material complicity, you know, it's different. And, you know, I'm, you know, we don't have responsibility over what an, a state does like thousands of miles away, but also we do when that state starts, you know, drops bombs with soldiers wearing Stars of David. You know, I don't wear a Star of David anymore because I feel like I can't, because I don't.
Yeah.
I don't so, feel able to.
Well, yeah. So exactly. You're being, you're being basically, it goes back to that homogenizing thing that you're like, whether it's everybody with a beard suddenly being Osama bin Laden or a Star of David only being able to mean one thing and meaning that thing quite stridently, you're just, you're having to hide in your own.
Totally. And I think, and it's why it's so important, first of all, for those of us who want to continue being Jewish, to like think about what is a Judaism beyond Israel, beyond Zionism, and build out those traditions and those institutions, and really hold our own communal institutions to account on that. But I think the other thing that has happened, I think talking, going back to that sense of what happened about accusations and instrumentalization of anti-Semitism being used to destroy the left, is that obviously the mirror of that is that there was an intentional strategy to conflate criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism, and saying that, you know, if you if you want to hold Israel to the same standards as any country that purports to be democratic, that you're anti-Semitic, or supporting human rights is anti-Semitic. And what that has done, I think, is so damaging to the fight against anti-Semitism. But also, I think what's created in society is this polarization, whereas if you're right-wing, you want to combat anti-Semitism, and if you're left-wing, you want to support Palestine. And I think if the left want to make sure that they really are offering and building a political power that is able to take on the threats, who will use this issue of anti-Semitism to undermine the left continuously, as they have, we need to have a good understanding of how anti-Semitism is part of the broader anti-racist struggle, both morally, but also strategically. It's important for us how it is not incompatible to support Palestinian freedom and support Jewish safety. How, you know, from our perspective, we will never protect the Jewish community by oppressing Palestinians or repressing free speech on Palestine, and really offering clarity on these issues as a way to guide us through the challenges and the threats that we're about to face. Because if we don't face up to that, we're going to be stuck in the same holding patterns that we've been in for, I say, since, you know, since probably that 2019 election.
Yeah.
We need to move ahead with it.
Yeah, yeah, we also need to hold ourselves to account. There needs to be, the left needs to do far, far better. You know, the casual Islamophobia, the misogyny, the homophobia, the transphobia, the anti-Semitism.
The transphobia
is everywhere.
Yeah.
And, you know, there is a lot of anti-Semitism in the left. I've experienced it. And there's a lot of Islamophobia on the left as well. And the left is not a utopia. It's not a space that is safe and free for any one of us. You know, we have to create that.
Yeah,
and I think it's also about how we create it as well. Like, I think actually, you know, this is also about, you know, what does it mean to come at this from, you know, a non-carceral perspective? You know, we can't just be doing the sort of everyone, you know, people have to be able to have the opportunity to change and learn and really think about these issues. And I think particularly how we build out a shared sense of values on these issues, and, you know, how we don't undermine ourselves by allowing for perhaps the stereotype, the ideas that the right want to have of the left to like take hold actually in our movements. And I think also in terms of, you know, this issue, like I really value something like the campaign that Zoran Mamdani ran in New York, where it was very clear that he was saying wholeheartedly, like New York is a place for all New Yorkers, but you know, we can combat anti-Semitism and support a free Palestine and challenge Islamophobia and make sure, you know, we have an economically just society. That these things are actually possible and we can do it. And maybe there's a moment also for us in this time to be really learning from each other and assessing like what is actually working now. How are we who are the people doing the work to build those just societies and emulating that?
It really struck with me. I spoke to this lawyer who had been a UN special rapporteur. She said one of the hangovers from 9/11, basically, and terror and Islam becoming conflated, was that there was no way over time, as the narrative of kind of what a terrorist was and how you had to kind of how a society protected itself from the possibility of faith-driven terrorism, meant that scrolling forward 20 years, 25 years, there was no longer any category of male refugee. If you were a refugee, you had to be a woman or a child. Mm. If you weren't a woman or a child, you were more likely to be a terrorist. Mm. But I feel like there's actually, that's a pattern that's replicated in those kind of binaries. You're either this or you're that. You're either anti-Semitism or you're anti-Semitic. You're either anti-Islamophobic or you're, I'm not actually phrasing that very well, because obviously that is a fine binary. You're either anti-Semitism or you're anti-Semitic. But there are a number of binaries by category in terms of things that have been elided in the media, which mean that there are certain states which are no longer possible because the ideas are considered so incompatible.
Well, also, I think the narrative that the media often puts forward in the UK is either your the only way you can be anti-Semitic or like pro-Jewish community is to say that you're supportive of Israel.
Yeah.
And actually there are plenty of Jewish people where I would actually think that would be better for like British journalists and commentators and people to be focusing on like what actually protects the Jewish community here, like increased human rights protections for minority communities, you know, making sure that everyone feels like they belong. And what does that look like? As I say, like better economic conditions, you know, not just sort of farming out or externalizing how we address anti-Semitism by supporting a foreign nation state. Like this is the problem.
I think this also goes to the roots really of the lack of anti-racism education in this country, the lack of understanding of what that actually really looks like and what it should look like as well. Once upon a time, it looked a particular way. Now, I think quite a lot of anti-racism has become very performative.
Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, we are now in 2026 and there's still no clear definition of what Islamophobia is, which the government is grappling with at the moment. Yeah. And there's a denial of Islamophobia. So rightly so, if a person or institution denies anti-Semitism, rightly so, they will be pulled up and called out for it loudly.
Yeah.
The same cannot be said of Islamophobia. Islamophobia, is very much part of the DNA of this country. And, you know, it's denied every day. It's denied all day long. People are like, oh, Muslims are not a race. Of course Muslims are not a race. The thing is, Muslims are pathologized as a race.
Yeah.
And therefore, we need to understand that Islamophobia is racism. And so I think the left in particular has got a very big job to do here in relation to its supposed anti-racist values. Because, you know, Islamophobia and anti-Semitism are the same coin, two different faces of the same coin. Where you have one, you'll absolutely have the other. There's a synergy between both of them.
I mean, we saw that after the Manchester attack. Two days later, there was an attack on a mosque.
Yeah, and it's historic, and it's current and it's ongoing. And yet, what we have is people in power trying to pit our communities constantly against each other, and the media very much buying into that as well.
Yeah,
and it's shocking.
Yeah, definitely.
And it definitely, you know, I think it's really true what you're saying, Shaiser. And I think particularly, like, it is, you know, it is true that actually I think a lot of politicians and mainstream politicians do want to show more concern or care about issues of anti-Semitism than Islamophobia, than anti-trans, transphobia, anti-migrant issues. You know, we've seen the way in which Labour has really tried to stake its politics on a horrifically racist immigration reform plan. And that is incredibly dangerous and creates this hierarchy of racism and actually fails to really look at how you address oppression. You know, we know that in spaces where, you know, one group is attacked, the others soon follow. We know that when you allow, like, these things are also all interconnected. And unless we have politicians and political leaders and people in the movement really seeing that and wanting to address these things collectively and together, whilst also recognizing the specificities might be different.
And it also fuels this false fantasy that the only minority that is offered any protection are Jewish people and Jewish communities, which is not true, as we know, because we've seen the number of attacks, just like Islamophobia, anti-Semitism has, you know, gone up massively, hugely in the last, particularly in the last 2.5 years of the live streamed Gaza genocide. You know, none of our communities are safe. We're more at risk than any other time. And that is the truth. And yet the way, you know, we're being pitted against each other does not allow that truth to come through.
But I think it's also about what politics does it serve when it's, you know, you have us scrambling and fighting at the bottom. So it's distraction away from the sort of systemic problems that exist in our society.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
What politics does it serve to show more care, or allegedly more care? I don't actually think it's real care. I think that's also the point. It's, you know, it's serving a political purpose. Yeah, and it's serving a political purpose to distract away from, you know, maybe the actions of the government or the state at the time, but also away from, you know, the fact that, you know, people in power also know that, you know, us all working together might be a threat to them. And so there is this attempt, this divide and rule. It's, you know, it's textbook in many ways.
Okay, I want to end this segment with a recommendation from both of you. Anything you've been reading or watching or listening to, I think it should be apropos to our world, but I also think literally everything is relevant to our world. I can do a podcast while you think about it.
Yeah. I mean, I've got I actually came with a list.
Okay, yeah, you do your list.
Yeah, so this great book called The Othered Woman, How White Feminism Harms Muslim Women by Shahad Ayazadi. I really recommend everyone reads that. There's another great book here by Tania Saeed, Islamophobia and Securitization, Religion, Ethnicity and the Female Voice. Notice a bit of a theme here, sisters? So, yeah.
I would read both of those today.
My recommendations are the writing and works of Huey P. Newton, who's one of the founders of the Black Panther Party, who wrote a lot about, you know, organizing and racial justice and racial struggles. And I find it really helpful to read issues that I think are interconnected, but also from other movements to think about what insights can be brought to the work that I'm doing. And then the second thing I would like to recommend is a report by the Runnymede Trust into anti-Semitism in the UK, which came out last year, but I think is a really great great summation of the issues affecting British politics and how anti-Semitism intersects with that, how to address it. And that was done in conjunction with BISA, the Birkbeck Institute for the Study of Anti-Semitism, who are also great. So anything by BISA or the Runnymede Trust, I would strongly recommend.
Yeah, and interesting enough, actually, it's the Runnymede Trust that in 1997, they wrote a report that led to the term Islamophobia.
Oh, really?
Being known as a mainstream term. And they've got a report called Islamophobia, A Challenge for All of Us, which was published in 1997. And as you say, they do great work and they continue to do great work.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
I did not know that. I've been reading The Lucifer Effect, which is a kind of 90s book. No, it's a 2000s book by Philip Zimbardo. It's basically who goes bad in a authoritarian system, or like what structural effects enable people to perpetrate evil against one another. And it's just on my mind a lot, especially watching the US, that, like, you know, you look at the people who are resisting the kind of encroachments of fascist acts, but there's a lot of people who aren't resisting. And are they not resisting? And why aren't they? Anyway, it's quite interesting. I haven't got the answers yet, but that's because I haven't finished it. Hopefully I'll get to the end and I'll know all the answers. We'll take a break here to hear about an organisation that's doing great work and how you can get involved.
My name is Nandita. I'm the director of CADFA, which is a human rights charity based in Camden, but actually working across England and Wales to raise understanding of the human rights situation in Palestine and encourage people to be active in promoting human rights. We bring people together because we discover that bringing people from Palestine together with people from here to allow people to interact as ordinary human beings and to understand something about each other's lives is an incredibly powerful way of getting people to want the best for the others. The thing that we've got to be best known for in the last 20 years are the visits that we've organised from here to Palestine and Palestine to here. The visits bringing Palestinians to Britain are so amazingly productive. We get a lot of good feedback from the Palestinians involved in them. If you bring young people here and they can go to schools and youth clubs and, you know, play football and do art and make drama with young people here, it really interests young people here, and we hear about it, you know, then we hear about it years later when people say they started to be interested because they'd met young people from Palestine on our visits. The next thing that we're working for is a visit to here of women from Palestine, which will be fantastic. It will involve a women's conference, a women's sort of cultural event, and lots of meetings with women in women's centres and community groups all over the country, actually. And so if you'd like to be involved in those things, actually fundraising is incredibly helpful because we're not funded by anybody but our partners and individuals who want to help. And you can find out how to do that from cadfor.org or contact@cadfor.org.
We're going to do a full episode on Gaza later in the series, centering Palestinian voices. But for this conversation, it's unignorable what impact the genocide has had on both Islamophobia and anti-Semitism worldwide. So it has thrown into sharp relief how the international community, how the global media, the value they put on Muslim lives, and how that value is relative. And do you feel like that kind of necropolitics has foregrounded Islamophobia that was already there, or it was enabled by Islamophobia?
I think both, really. I think Islamophobia has also enabled the mass killing of Palestinians, at least 70,000 of whom have been genocided in Gaza in 2.5 years. And I think you can only really, globally, you only really get away with doing that if you've dehumanised people to such an extent that global leaders can choose to look the other way, and there's not really many implications for them doing so. I think that definitely Islamophobia has fueled that genocide, and it's fueled, as I said, you know, as somebody who's not Palestinian, who lives here, who's born and raised in the UK, I can honestly tell you that I am a totally different person to the one that I was before the genocide. I can never go back to being who I was before. I no longer feel that sense of belonging in the way that I did before. I don't feel safe in the way that I did to an extent before. You know, to be watching these utterly horrific images day in, day out, and to know that the world overwhelmingly, not the people of the world, just to be clear, I'm talking about the people who run the world, overwhelmingly have kind of decided to turn the other cheek. Yeah. And this genocide is ongoing. And, you know, what does it tell the rest of us? What does it, it tells us everything. It tells us everything about, you know, what we once believed in. We can no longer believe in that. I mean, I wasn't naive enough to believe that the West is the bastion of civilization and believes that all of our lives are equal or anything like that. And, you know, I did think that international law mattered and international human rights law matters. And I still believe it does. However, we are seeing every single day, you know, especially since Trump's come back into power, how all of this, the rights-based order, all of that has just been thrown into the sea, and it can't be salvaged again, really. And I think, you know, we haven't even got to the end of the genocide. It's still ongoing. The way business is implicated in this, global business, capitalism, the political system, you know, all of that. It's I just think that, you know, I'm not really sure how we find a way back from there. But the only way to find a way back from there is to center and anchor the humanity of Palestinians and their right to life, their right to live a life of dignity, their right to live as free people, And their right to live on their land. Mm. Because if we don't ensure that those rights are upheld, then already we're seeing all our rights everywhere being fundamentally undermined, our right to free speech, our right to protest. I mean, we just look at what's happening here with Palestine Action and lots of other things, and you look at what's happening in the US, it's all interconnected.
Yeah.
And then if you also look at the way refugees and migrants are being further dehumanised in the last 2.5 years of this live stream genocide, it's catastrophic. And the genie's out of the bottle now. And, you know, it's really hard sometimes to convince people who've got grievances about the way Western foreign policy is conducted that it doesn't have to be this way and we can create a different world. Because what I'm concerned about is how, you know, the ongoing genocide is fueling that those grievances further, and is making more people feel alienated from the mainstream and the threats that poses to global security as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think first of all, I agree with everything Shaista said, and you know, I would go even further and say I think not only did they turn the other cheek, but they actually actively
aided and abetted
and armed and sent support. And I think that is something that we must never let these governments forget. But I think also, yeah, I think what we have seen, particularly in terms of, you know, the way in which politicians have really ignored and actively tried to suppress and repress the very clear and increasingly mainstream public outcry against Israel's genocide in Gaza, and that you had hundreds of thousands of people taking to the streets, making their position known through their wallets about what products they buy, you know, boycotts, etc., and increasingly making that be seen as some kind of, you know, whether that's, you know, whether they use the excuse of saying it was anti-Semitic or whether it was just simply, you know, anti-British. I think that's basically where we got to with the conversation around whether it's okay or not okay to throw paint on military planes. That felt like it was really, we're actually having a conversation about British patriotism and who belongs and who doesn't. Is that what we see in those times is when people feel like they have no power to affect the people that rule over them, that they are told actually they should have that through democratic processes, that anger doesn't go away. It's just directed into other spaces.
Yeah.
And whether that's directed, you know, that can be directed at Jewish people. And that's what I mean when I talk about, we'll come back to this, but when I talk about how Jewish people haven't been safe in the wake of what's happening in Gaza, but also in terms of, I think, you know, Islamophobia and that sort of sense of, you know, who are these, you know, I think Tommy Robinson was talking about taking back the streets from Hamas, like when he did his racist riots the other, in 2024, you know, that really was obviously very coded in this idea, again, of using the geopolitical context to push a narrative in Britain about who belongs, who doesn't, who is British, who isn't. And that's incredibly dangerous for both Muslim and Jewish communities.
Yeah, and the government having the absolute audacity to say that hundreds and thousands of people on the streets of this country from all walks of life who are utterly befret at seeing the pieces of children scattered on the streets of Gaza are marchers and hate mongers. Absolutely outrageous.
Beyond outrageous.
And so, so dangerous that not only have you been busy dehumanising the people who are being genocided on our TV screens and on our phones, you know, through the live streaming of this genocide, the Palestinians, but then you're also demonising anyone who says not in my name.
Yeah.
I refuse to allow this to happen. I'm standing up for decency and humanity. And we've all been dehumanised. So, the Gary Linekers of the world who've lost their jobs, to lots of other people, everyday people who feel like they can't go into work and show their sorrow and their deep devastation of what they are witnessing every day. It's just utterly appalling.
But I do think that it's, it is like particularly people of colour have been affected by this in a particular way. And that is also how it is so racialised as well.
I mean, I can't tell you, I'm sat here wearing this kefir and I deliberately wear this kefir. Some people think it's a provocative act. I tell you what it is. It creates opportunity for other like-minded people who'd feel too scared to talk to someone else to come up to me and talk to me. And overwhelmingly, I'll tell you who's coming up to talk to me, white men. at bus stops, at the train station. They start conversations with me saying, have you been to a protest? And I'll say, no, I wear this all the time. And then they start talking to me and tell me how devastated they are by seeing the genocide, and they don't know what to do about it. They don't know who to speak to, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I find that really fascinating that they are looking to connect with people, and I look nothing like them, and you know, my reality and theirs is very different, and yet, you know, we can connect at a very deep human level based on the shared values that we have, that we don't want to see anyone genocided, and we want this genocide in Gaza to stop. And this is a message to the politicians. You know, if a Muslim woman and a random white guy on a Wednesday afternoon in Oxford standing at the bus stop can have a deep conversation about your failed foreign policies, then, you know, you need to do better, really.
Yeah.
There's something that I, you know, I think what is also, you know, there's been, I think, actually real moments of, I don't want to say hope, because obviously that feels ridiculous in the face of so many people.
I think there's hope, Em.
Okay.
A lot of hope.
But I think what we have seen, I think particularly thinking about, there's two points. Mm. The first is that one thing I've started doing when anyone starts to talk to me about Jewish safety in the wake of the genocide in Gaza is I feel like it's incredibly important to say that it is increasingly clear that nothing Israel has done in the last 2.5 years has in any way helped keep Jewish people safe anywhere. If anything, I think it has actually made us put us in more danger than we were before. I think when you actively say that you are committing a genocide in the name of defending Jewish people and protecting Jewish people, you are putting targets on our backs. And it's about time that we have that conversation, both in our communities, but also in our public sphere. Mm-hmm. And it's really important. And this is the fundamental where I, you know, one of the reasons I'm not a Zionist, I'm an anti-Zionist Jew, is because I don't believe, you know, first of all, the moral cost of what Israel does is far too high to ever justify this being in the name of Jewish safety. But I also think the project has failed to keep Jewish people safe. And if that's the case, we need to be looking for new ways of thinking about what does keep Jewish people safe. And I would say it's in deep relationship and solidarity with people like Shyster and every other community and people that are affected by extremism and political violence. But I think the second thing that's happened is that what I have witnessed in my community, what I've witnessed on the marches is, and what I've witnessed in the organizing in general, is like the fracture that needed to happen and the challenge to the way in which, you know, Israel sort of, and support for Israel can dominate communal life is shifting. You know, we're seeing thousands of more Jewish people around the world speaking up and taking a stand in this time and saying that this will not happen in our name, that this is not something, this is not how we keep safe, that this is, that we are in solidarity with Palestinians, that we are fighting for Palestinian liberation alongside everyone else in the Palestine Solidarity Movement. And that to me actually shows a real shift and a possibility that things will be different. And I really hope that pillar of support that upholds Israeli occupation and apartheid really might be beginning to crumble.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah. And I also think the conversation we need to have in Britain is the acknowledgement that the seeds of this genocide were planted in the Balfour Declaration,
which
comes out of the seeds of anti-Semitism. So when this country was supposed to offer real refuge to Jewish people, literally running for their lives, what did they do? We know what they did. You know, many of them turned their backs on Jewish people and decided to go and, inverted commas, move the problem over there. And so this is, history has a way of repeating itself. And in particular in this country, there's a lack of a desire to really own up to this, to own up to what anti-Semitism, deep-seated anti-Semitism in Europe, what it led to. What it stopped, what it didn't, what it refused to stop, which was a mass slaughter of Jewish people and other people as well at the same time. And then that has led us to where we are now. And there's no responsibility being taken whatsoever. I mean, you know, we've got to a situation now where, you know, the health secretary has released his WhatsApp messages to Lord Mandelson. And he's openly saying in there that Israel is committing war crimes in plain sight. He's talking about it on his WhatsApp. He's refusing to speak about it as an elected member of the cabinet, the secretary of health. So why is he only willing to say that on a WhatsApp? Why is he not willing to come out and say that, you know, I see the state of Israel committing war crimes every day against the Palestinian people in Gaza. This must stop. And as a member of this government, what am I going to do to make sure we stop selling arms to Israel, that we recognize that these arms must stop, and we call for accountability from the state of Israel, and we want to uphold the International Criminal Court arrest warrant for Benjamin Netanyahu and a whole swathe of other things. But it's not happening, is it? And I think that's this is all part of the performative kind of solidarity that is shown.
Well, just on the subject of why Britain actually is the source of most of the problems in the world that we experience today, the first piece of anti-immigration legislation in this country was the 1905 Aliens Act, which was about prohibiting Jewish immigration from Eastern Europe,
right?
Because they were concerned mm-hmm. about the downplay or the rejection of wages, and also this idea of that, you know, obviously that, you know, Jewish people didn't belong, but then you wouldn't have fish and chips. So but I think that's incredibly, it's very true what you say around the, you know, the fact that the international context has an impact on our lives here, and the fact that, you know, what we have essentially seen over the last 2.5 years is the devaluing of life, the devaluing of Palestinian life, the devaluing of Muslim and brown people's life, of Arab life, and that is of course going to have reverberations for you know, other political issues, other sort of issues around human rights, whether that be migration and asylum, whether that be around tackling Islamophobia. You know, the fact that you know, even Starmer could not come out and call the racist riots last summer Islamophobic is just extraordinary, and really speaks to the way in which the far right have mainstreamed themselves into British politics at the behest, or, you know, as with the handmaidens of the Labour Party. Like, it's absolutely disgraceful, and puts so many of us at risk as a result, puts the very democratic positions of us, which are not perfect. No one is saying they're perfect, but they did a job. Now they might be gone. And it just feels like we are in a really turbulent and stable time that makes me feel very worried, but also very grateful to be able to have these kinds of conversations and be in relationship with people like
that. And I think this is where the hope is, because, you know, the status quo has crumbled.
And, but that is where the despair is as well, because exactly as you say about, you know, losing that, there is a kind of sense of innocence that you kind of, the thing where you trust the grown-ups, where part of you always thinks the UN will do the right thing in the end, where, you know, international rules-based order, for all that I don't actually know exactly what it's supposed to mean, I always believed in it anyway. And that has all gone, but maybe...
I think more people are waking up, and they're questioning everything, and they're trying to build those connections and find ways to be in solidarity with each other. And people are, you know, wondering, why am I going to the food bank after working all the hours, you know, possible, and I still can't make ends meet? And it's not because, you know, there's a guy there in a dinghy trying to make his way to the shore in Dover. That's not the reason why. You know, people are starting to wake up. They're starting to understand that this story that I was told is not keeping me safe. It's not allowing me to get fed or keep my, you know, roof over my children's head, et cetera, et cetera. And I think this is a very powerful moment. And one of the reasons why there's so much extreme violence being unleashed by states everywhere is because they know that the game's up. People are not looking to them anymore for answers to you know, provide our safety and security. Of course, you know, I think we do need to find a way to get back to a rules-based order, even though we know that the rules did not apply to everyone. They were only there to protect some people, not all people. We know that, okay? But we do need to have some a mechanism there that will enable us to get out of some of this chaos. But I think what we need to do is we need to build a far more equitable and fairer world, for real, as opposed to like the thought of having one, because it wasn't there.
Yeah.
I do wonder. I mean, I've been reading a lot of and watching and listening to actually like other societies that have lived under dictatorship, which may sound a bit extreme, but I do think there's, you know, I think something that also happens particularly in sort of white or Anglo-Western societies, as we kind of think of ourselves as exceptional, and that mm-hmm. these things could not possibly happen here. Mm-hmm. We couldn't possibly, as the founders of parliamentary democracy, get rid of our democracy. And actually, hey, like, there's a lot of things happening right now which is really about restricting our rights. And I think that we can take a lot of comfort in actually, like, turning to other contexts where people have resisted and challenged these systems, whether that be in Brazil or Argentina, in apartheid South Africa. Like, really, taking the... we don't have to reinvent the wheel, but also there's historical precedent here that we can hold on to. And I think also, you know, one of the reasons I do this work is because I am in relationship with Palestinian communities in Misafiyata in the West Bank, who literally the stakes are, if we aren't able to find a way to help support them to stay on their land, they are literally going to be driven out of there in the next 6 to 8 months. Mm-hmm. And that is something that, you know, is the reason I keep going, because it's not just also just for me. It's not just for the UK. It's for, like, everyone is interconnected and we have to be resisting. And if we do not find ways to put pressure on those in power to take the right choice and hold Israel accountable, to challenge the ways in which, you know, our human rights are being degraded, that our civil liberties, you know, these attacks on migrants, etc., then, you know, we can't just be for ourselves. What mm-hmm. are we going to do? You know, this society, yeah. we're in such a dangerous time that I really think it's important for us all to be looking to what we can do to look after each other and really build out these bonds of international solidarity.
That, you know, if you're not safe, Em, I'm not safe.
No.
None of us are safe, right? Mm-hmm. And vice versa, right? It's like we're all connected. We're all connected. And I think since COVID, I think there's a bit more of awareness around that, actually. I think, mm-hmm. you know, community, this whole concept of community, I think, through mutual aid in particular, has taken on a different meaning to people. You know, we've heard these stories before, but for lots of people, they didn't even know who their neighbours were before the COVID pandemic hit, right? And so I think this whole thing about what you just said, you know, about individualism, exceptionalism, this is what a lot of Western societies are built on. And it's like, well, that's not going to help any one of us, right? We have to understand that, you know, we've got to be together, we've got to be in contact with each other, we've got to have relations with each other, and that's the only way that society's ever survived.
Right, so that's all we've got time for today. I hope you've enjoyed it. Counterpower is a fortnightly podcast produced by Another Europe Is Possible, Global Justice Now and Stop Trump Coalition. Our aim is to bring together experts and activists to talk about global justice and inspire you, our audience, into action. So if you don't know our networks and organisations, look us up. Get involved. There's a lot to do. And remember, you can support Counterpower by going to patreon.com/counterpower. And whatever you do, don't forget to like, subscribe, follow Counterpower. Maybe even leave us a nice review. We'll see you again in 2 weeks' time.